after how close we are on these amendments passing. Now, Representative Alan Bates wishes to question.
Mr. Chair. I'm going to ask questions about something just to clarify what the heck we're talking about here, okay? And the A6 is we presently pay nurse practitioners in the Oregon Health Plan under Medicaid, but under federal law, you usually have to have a nurse practitioner have be signed off by a physician. It's not true in the commercial market, but it is for Medicare, and I believe it is for Medicaid. So my guess is this has something to do with a nurse practitioner practicing in a rural area and not being signed off by a physician, or that physician who's being signed off, who's going to pay the physician to sign off on those charts. And I'm guessing that's what we're talking about. Is that correct?
No.
Or am I wrong about that? What's the purpose of this amendment?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bates, you want me to answer that question or the proponents of
this
amendment?
All right. Either. If you don't know the answer, do you have the answer?
I do.
Well, then please do so. I mean, you know, I don't mean to put you on the spot, but go right at it.
My back's awful. Mr. Chair, I have to say he is the great, wondrous Dr. Bates, because I can stand up today, and I couldn't stand up last week.
Well,
couldn't stand
pleased.
Up straight.
Yeah.
So I'm very appreciative.
Never take care of me.
You never asked.
Well, I'm not going to.
Actually, you're safe. You're a Democrat.
Yeah, yeah.
You take the question.
Please answer his question.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bates, this involves a situation where there is a fully capitated health plan in a certain rural area of this state. There's also within that area a rural health clinic. The practitioners at the clinic are not allowed to participate in the fully capitated health plan, and so they had, in order to see OHP clients, had to get their own supervising doctor, and this would force them to this would allow them actually to get paid as one way of resolving that situation.
So I was close at least. Is it required by federal law that they have a physician sign those charts off to get paid?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bates, yes.
So the problem is that they have to have a physician sign off, and somebody has to pay that physician, either the nurse practitioners at the clinic or someone inside the health care plan.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bates, yes.
Yeah.
So now we're down, it's about money.
I'm three for three. Mr. Chair, Representative Bates, yes.
Mr. Chair?
1 second, please. Are you through, Senator Representative Bates?
Yes, I am.
Senator Bill Fishing, you want to comment?
Well, Mr. Chair, I believe that they have a physician that takes care of their records, but they do not have a method of billing because they are not allowed to practice in the hospital. They don't have hospital privileges. And I think this is just a situation where they have to run through the doctor, and then the doctor winds up taking a cut out of their pay of some $300 or $400 a month, so that they're short that amount of money in the operation of their clinic, basically, and it goes to somebody else. It's just there as a matter of expediency to get the billing done. So I don't think it's a necessary thing that they have to do to match a federal law that they can't match in another way. At least that's my understanding of it.
Senator Jackie Winter.
Oh, I just wanted to comment. I guess both sides, it's about money.
Okay. 15-mile rule is about money. All right.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Bill Morissette.
It all comes back to me now.
What was it, the money?
No. The situation comes back to me, and I think this is a good rule because we're talking health care in rural Oregon where it's difficult. And you have a nurse practitioner who practices, and they shouldn't have to necessarily split their fee with a physician 50 miles or more away. So I'm satisfied
related to
this rule.
Thank you. Any other concerns? Senator John Minnis.
Well, I'm a little bit confused because it was said that a physician has to sign off by federal law. Does this violate federal law?
Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, no.
Okay, I guess I'll trust you, whatever. Okay.
Well, you're looking at me as though you trust me.
I'm trusting, actually, Kate Brown here.
Thanks, because I haven't said a word. I have said nothing about this 15 minutes. All right, to reach closure on this, it seems to me, is there any other questions or concerns on the DAS-6 amendments? I'm not asking for a vote now, but it appears as though this one might have a chance of surviving. All right. DAS-A-10, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the ATINs do a number of things. They modify the definition of fully capitated health plan to specify that the plan must have an adequate network of providers to ensure access. It deletes the requirement that hospitals may not decline to treat OHP clients enrolled in an FCHIP. It provides that if an FCHIP is not able to contract with an adequate network of providers, that they can request arbitration assistance from the Office of Health Plan Policy and Research, and that if a FCHIP does not contract with a hospital for outpatient or inpatient services, the FCHIP must reimburse the hospital for the lesser of either bill charges or a percentage of Medicare DRG rates. It requires that the hospital, not having a contract, accept that reimbursement rate. And finally, it exempts A and B hospitals from this section dealing with payment.
Senator Kay Brown has a question.
Thank you. Ms. Robinson, would you please distinguish the -A10 amendments from the -A15 amendments?
A15 and A10 are now going to be discussed together.
Mr. Chair, Senator Brown, is this a test? There are two. At first glance, there are two changes. The blank that is in the A10s has been filled in, and it's filled in to be 80% of Medicare charges. And then the second change is that the sentence of 80% of Medicare in the A15s has a period at the end. It gets rid of the reference to DRG rates, which then makes it applicable to both inpatient and outpatient rates. DRG rates are inpatient rates only.
Thank you.
I'm getting notes.
My hand was up before you even got here. Are you not remembering?
Senator Margaret Carter, please.
Thank you. Counsel, can you tell me that in the event there is arbitration, that it's non-binding? Why would it be here if it's non-binding?
Mr. Chair, Senator Carter, because that's what the proponents requested. I guess they thought it would help them if there was a neutral recommendation made and that they could accept or not accept.
I see. Thank you.
Another
question, yes.
Sure. Go ahead.
Why were A and B hospitals exempted?
Mr. Chair, Senator Carter, they should have been exempted all along. There are such a statutory provisions that direct that A and B hospitals be reimbursed at full cost, and they should never have been. It was a drafting error on my part, basically, and they should have been exempt from the beginning.
Okay.
Senator Bill Morissette.
Thank you. I think non-binding arbitration is an oxymoron. Because why? Yeah, I mean, mediation would be a better word, and I don't understand why they don't have binding arbitration if they're going to it should be binding. But I would suggest mediation if you want to just get them together.
Mr. Chair and Senator Morissette, I'm smiling only because when I presented those same words to the proponents of the bill, they said very specifically, no, we don't want mediation, we want arbitration, we want somebody to go away and give us a recommendation, and then we can accept it or reject it, but we don't want to have to sit around and hold hands and make some agreement. And that's so I left it as non-binding arbitration.
Ridiculous.
Senator John Minnis will comment on this.
Well, I'm not sure how helpful it will be, but does the Federal Arbitration Act play any role when you use the words arbitration as opposed to mediation?
Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, I don't believe so.
Okay. Are there other concerns, issues, objections to the -A10 amendments? -A11, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, these basically would remove from the ASO, the Administrative Services Contracts piece, and from the capitation rate piece, drugs that are dispensed by institutional pharmacies to residents of nursing facilities and community-based residential care programs. And actually the BPM piece. So this is the set of amendments that removes institutional pharmacies from the bill.
Senator Kate Brown.
Thanks. Ms. Robinson, I assume there wouldn't be a fiscal, that it would just reduce the savings anticipated by the bill?
Mr. Chair, Senator Brown, I don't know how LFO has factored in specifically institutional drugs dispensed by institutional pharmacies and what percentage of drugs under the health plan that they are. So the answer is I don't know.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Bill Fisher, please.
Yeah, part of that reasoning is that those are individual bubble packed medications, and they're handled entirely differently than the regular bulk medication. I think that's largely the extent of it, and somehow or another they were thrown in with the OMAPs at one time, and probably should never have had that happen, but they did.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Mark Carter.
Since you're not clear, can the proponents of this amendment come and explain this in their own words?
I don't see anyone here.
Paul. Paul Cosgrove, I'm hearing your name.
Sorry.
You're about to hear it again. Senator Carter, please.
Record Paul Cosgrove.
Paul, I fully don't get this, and maybe my brain is just exhausted by this time of day, but would you make the distinction for me between institutional pharmacies being engaged in nursing facilities patients and why? Explain that. I'd
be happy to, Mr. Chairman. Senator Carter, institutional pharmacies supply only people who are in institutional residential care, nursing facilities, adult foster. They don't do a retail pharmacy business. And as such, they have all these special requirements, 24-hour, 7-day week, multiple deliveries, bubble packs and blister packs, very special packaging. All of the care for the health services to those people in those facilities, nursing homes, is outside of OMAP, except for their pharmacy services. And so we are in a totally different system, and what this does is just recognize that totally different system. Representative Bates, I think, will agree with me that when the House was considering this bill, it was only at the last minute this distinction was even brought up. I don't think anybody contemplated institutional pharmacies being under this bill because they're always treated separately, and this clarifies that they are treated separately. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Thank you.
All right. Representative Alvarez, you're now happy.
He has explained it better than I could.
Okay.
Thank you, Paul. Thank you.
Look like you're happy.
Other questions, concerns, or objection to dash A11? 812, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the A12s do a number of things. They conform the definition of American Indian and Alaska Native beneficiary to federal law. It requires the organizations to which enrollees are being assigned to notify each enrollee within 30 days with information about how they may contact their providers. It establishes a methodology for setting capitation rates for physician care organizations, which was not contemplated in the A&F version of the bill. It requires the department to consider competency and cost neutrality in the additional contracting provisions, because in one section of the bill, this expands it to all of the new contracts that the department would be required to do. And finally, it moves the operative date from a date certain of October 1st to a date contingent on the approval from CMS that we can do this.
Questions? Concerns? Senator Bill Morissette.
Thank you. On page 2, does not apply to, now I'm assuming that it does not apply to people from lines 9 through 24 because they're already covered somewhere.
Mr. Chair, Senator Morissette, I'm pulling out my copy of the amendments. No.
Section 1.
Section 3. Well, what's new in Section 12, the A-12s were written as a gut and stuff replacement of the bill. And so this new language regarding Native Americans shows up in two places. It's on page 2, lines 12 and 13, and then it's further defined on page 3 at the top, lines 2 to 9.
Well,
but the rest of this is what's currently in the bill.
Okay, I guess my question is, why are these, okay, person who's eligible, line 17, for Medicaid, a woman in her third trimester, and so on and so on, these people are already covered.
This is, Right. When the A-12s were written as a gut and stuff of the bill, so there's duplications between what's in the A and gross version of the bill and what's in this bill. And I mean, these are individuals who already, in the bill, when the bill came to the Senate, the department had authority by rule to exempt from the mandatory enrollment requirements.
Why? Is what I meant.
I mean, why was the bill written this way?
Why were they exempt? Are they covered somewhere else?
Mr. Chair, Senator Moore said these were individuals whom the department and others believed should remain in the fee-for-service payment system.
Oh, okay,
system.
Okay. So the
they're only exempt from the mandatory enrollment.
That was my question. They are in the fee-for-service and not in mandatory enrollment.
Correct.
The medically fragile, for instance, are
correct.
In fee-for-service.
Right.
That's was my question. Thank you.
Other questions, comments, concerns, objections? Dash A-13.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, these address a number of issues, some of which arise from the department's implementation of Senate Bill 819 from last session. The second two bullets would require the department to not adopt or amend any prior authorization rules for drugs not on the PDL or the practitioner managed prescription drug plan, and states that any rules adopted would not be effective. It also would authorize the department to conduct prospective drug utilization review for drugs for individuals who have high drug usage.
Sir John Mess.
Well, I guess, Holly, you might want to address some of the discussion that we had in Legislative Council Committee with respect to the administrative rule drafted by the Department of Resources with respect to Senate Bill 819 and prior authorization. And I guess I can just summarize it in saying that Legislative Council agrees that the rule adopted by DHS is contrary to the law adopted in Senate Bill 819. So to some degree, by including this amendment in the bill, it would clarify by law what the law is and make null, hopefully, that administrative rule. It would be very, very, very clear that we meant to say what we said in Senate Bill 819. There is embedded in the A13 amendment a concept that's known as the Muse study. From the 2001 session, some members of the legislature may recall discussions regarding that issue of the multiplicity of medications that are used by certain individuals. So you, in essence, have a codification of what we did in 819, and hopefully the department would eventually move to write their administrative rules consistent with that. But with respect to the Muse issue, there is currently data and information will be provided to the committee very quickly or soon that will show that the Muse study as written in this bill will save up to $28 million by the application of this methodology, management of prescription medications, as opposed to the underlying reason why the governor's office included prior authorization in their budget, which was a savings of some $12 million. So I guess from my perspective as a politician and as a member of the Senate, the A13 simply codified what I believe was the law as it was passed by the 2001 legislative session and was consistent with the agreements that was made in negotiations with myself and Governor Kitzhaber at the time. And then I think further tries to identify savings so that the $12 million savings assumed in the current governor's budget becomes a moot point.
Senator Kingbaum, please.
Thanks. I agree with the concepts. I'd like to see verification in terms of savings and or potential costs as a result of this specific provision.
Sure. And I agree, Mr. Chair. That ought to be provided in the committee.
Other questions, concerns, comments, objections? A-14, next page.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, as this committee knows, as aware, and as I have described, currently what are known as the 7-Eleven drugs, which are antipsychotics and antidepressants, are carved out of the capitation rates and are provided on a fee-for-service basis to individuals receiving health services. What the A14s do is directly or specifically codify this practice by requiring that all antipsychotics and antidepressant drugs be paid for on a fee-for-service basis.
Questions, comments, concerns, objections? Representative Alan Bates.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Essentially, this takes the ability for the, if I understand it properly, for the managed care plans, takes their ability away to manage antidepressants and minor tranquilizers and opens it all up to fee-for-service strictly. Now, the commercial plans, we commonly manage these drugs, and in OHP we have not. We think there might be significant cost savings in managing those drugs other than antipsychotics, which we don't want to be involved in. Those should stay fee-for-service. Is that my understanding of what this section does?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bates, this section maintains the status quo.
Which is what?
I think the answer is yes to your question.
Thank you. So it's a significant change from the original bill, and it takes the plan away from looking like a commercial plan and back to the old way of doing things. So you don't have to answer that question.
Thank you.
Senator John Menis, please.
Mr. Chairman, Holly, again, the A14s are also consistent with Senate Bill 819, if I'm not mistaken.
Mr. Chair, Senator Menis, yes. Well...
Well, 819 actually is a little broader, if I understand correctly.
Mr. Chair, Senator Menis, when you look at the codification of Senate Bill 819 and the conditions that were carved out as chronic conditions, I don't know that mental health drugs or mental health diagnoses were specifically carved out. Mm-hmm. There was a catch-all phrase that talked about chronic and ongoing and serious conditions.
Well,
which a serious chronic and serious mental illness would comply, and then there was a non-exclusive list.
Right.
There's not on that list specifically mental illness, but it would qualify as a condition under which 819 would apply.
Right.
That makes sense.
Right.
Further comments, questions, concerns, objections? Let's go on to A15. Although we've already, if we talked about A15 relative to A10, do we need more explanation?
No.
I want to ask counsel.
Mr. Chair, there are just two differences. As I pointed out earlier, the blank in terms of Medicare rates has been filled in. It's 80% Medicare, and it also is 80% of Medicare for outpatient and inpatient services. It's not tied only to DRG rates, which would be inpatient only.
And Bill Mark,
that I think is identical.
Well, I was going to ask that question of why 80%, why not 75%?
Mr. Chair, Senator Morris, that is probably as arbitrary and capricious as a lot of other decisions. The requesters asked for 80%, and so that's what I used to fill in the blanks.
Who knows if it's a fair price?
Is life fair? Senator John Miss?
Paul's going to say the effect of putting 80% in there in statute is what?
Yeah.
As opposed to blank.
Mr. Chair, Senator, I think people anticipate the blanks would be filled at some point.
Correct,
I think it was someone wanted a target to start having a conversation, but it's a little hard to set a rate based on a blank.
That's true, but if you send the bill to Ways and Means with 80% in it, then 80%
is in the bill, as opposed to proactively filling in the blank.
So perhaps, Mr. Chairman, the question is whether or not 80% is a wise choice or not, whether this committee wants to entertain that discussion or that's better suited for Ways and Means.
Question.
Senator Mark Carter.
What is present law in terms of this payment fee
disadvantage bill? Mr. Chair, Senator Carter, the Department of Human Services has developed rates with the assistance of their actuaries. I don't know what the actual rate is. What I am aware of is that there's two rates. There's a fee-for-service rate, which is some calculation that they've come up with, which, as I understand it, is... I want to say a little under 60%, 50-something%, I think. But they have a rate that they have calculated. And then some FTIPs and hospitals have entered an agreement for other rates. And those are rates that are set in, I don't even think they're set in administrative rule. They're just kind of out there and used by the department. There's nothing in statute right now regarding hospital rates or other rates.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to, if more you can get that information for us, I'd like to have that.
Okay.
And Mr. Chair, and I would like to further discuss the percentage of the rate before it comes down to me, because we may or may not be able to fulfill a quote percentage rate that's there within budget. So, again, I'm a little concerned about having something come into Ways and Means that I may not be able to implement.
Well, are you saying you want a blank or you want a number?
I want a blank.
You want a blank.
Yes.
So you want 10 over 15 when it comes to that. What in the name of the Lord?
I want music.
That, we're all hallucinating.
So, all right. But there is a relationship between 10 and 15. I haven't reconciled that in my own mind.
Yes.
I'm just pointing out, we go voting on these things. 10 and 15, there's some things going on there. Mm-hmm. So there's some hot spots here with 15 and 10. That's all I'm going to know for the record. Senator John Minnis, please.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I actually facilitated the drafting of this particular amendment with the 80%. I was wondering if the proponents would like to share with the committee what their rationale is for the 80% as opposed to...
Proponents?
Who are you?
Who are you?
Where are you?
And come forward and tell us about 80%. Only one proponent is coming up.
80%. For the record, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Jeff Hetherington, and I represent the fully capitated health plans. We asked for the draft of this amendment. It actually does... the only thing it does in terms of changing the engrossed version is it does put in a payment methodology for the for paying the hospitals that is different than using the OMAP fee for service rates. We use the 80% because that was a target figure. We've done some calculations on what that target figure is, and if we were going to redo them, we would say put in the blank for Senator Winters, because there are some significant differences as to what it does for various plans. With family care, it would probably cost us $250,000. With Lane Independent Practice, it would cost them $3.5 million. So there's some significant differences in the in the swing there, so we'd prefer the blank. But what the A15s do that the A10s don't is it maintains the mandate that hospitals have to see all Medicaid, and that's you know, that's fairly significant as far as we're concerned, because at this point we have not been able to reach any agreements with the with any other parties about making sure that we can get our patients into the hospitals, particularly in the Portland area.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I filled this chair just long enough so that Bruce Bishop...
what are we going to play, musical chairs now?
Good. Talking about the day.
I said one proponent, now they got the borough coming up here. We've heard from Jeff the Harrington. He wants a blank for Jackie Winters, but...
Yeah, in turn, you know, what was mentioned that I reacted to with Jeff, we obviously have a problem with the mandate to treat. In terms of we've done an analysis of the 80%. I mean, that is still 20% less than the Medicare program, which does not pay cost, but we would have no objection to working with the blank so that you can understand the ramifications of what that means in dollars.
Could you identify yourself, please?
Ken Rutledge, President, Oregon Association of Hospitals.
Thank you very much. I don't mean to embarrass you. Senator Kate Brown, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Rutledge, the other provision of the A15 says that applies to inpatient and outpatient rates, not just to inpatient. Could you talk to me about why that's important or not, depending upon your perspective?
Well, if you look at hospital services, outpatient probably represents, depending on the hospital, 30-40% of all utilization. There is now a Medicare, in effect, prospective payment system along the lines that they have for inpatient, and so it makes sense that if you're going to take a look at an equitable payment rate, that you need to look at it for both the inpatient and outpatient, because it represents such a significant portion of the business.
Okay. It appears... Representative Adam Bates, did you wish to say something?
I'd just like to explain, if I could, what this section really is trying to get at. You actually heard from both sides of the question here, with Jeff talking about the FCHIPs and Ken talking about the hospital position. We are trying to bring these two parties together to get them to contract with each other on capitation, and that thereby provide better access to the patients and do it at the best cost we can get. We spent weeks on this question, and the language you see before you is bits and pieces of that. we first chose to go with Medicare rates because Medicare rates are set by the federal government and are commonly accepted across the United States and by each individual hospital, which they are different for in the state, as something resembling what the true cost. Some hospitals would argue they do not cover costs. Some would say they barely cover costs. The fee-for-service rates set by OMAP are about 50 or 60% of the true cost of seeing those patients, which we feel is an unfair burden in many ways and results in cost shifting. On the other hand, the plans feel they can't live with higher rates unless their capitation rates change and reflect that also. So you have these two opposing forces fighting with each other, the net result being we don't get contracts signed. And that leads us to NPCOs instead of FGIPs. Now, this is very complex, but this language is designed to try to bring these two groups together and force them to the table and not load either side so well that the FGIPs could say, why should we contract? We can just force Medicaid rates in these people at 50 or 60%, and yet at the same time tell the hospitals, we want you to join in these contracts, and we want to leave enough incentive for you to go into them. And 70 to 80% of Medicare is probably about the area where they start thinking, okay, maybe we can kind of better deal with the FGIPs by working together and staying out. So it was an attempt to level the playing field between these two groups and bring them together so they can start working together instead of fighting with each other. I don't know if I explained it well enough for you, but that's what we're trying to do here.
Thank you, Representative Alan Bates. It's obvious that we got some problems with these dash 15 amendments. And also,
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bill Morissette.
Yes. I heard somewhere that there was a disadvantage to LIPA in Lane County on this 80%. Is that true? I represent LIPA, so I have to protect their interest. And I'm kind of curious about how uneven this play field is going to be if we do the 80%. Which is more than some people.
You want to answer that?
Mr. Chair and Senator Morissette, I'm not sure that the committee wants to get into this discussion, but I will tell you that in figuring the difference between a percentage of Medicare against what is current practice of using the OMAP fee-for-service rates by the plans, in the Portland area, you can pretty well come in at about 78% of Medicare on average for all the hospitals. However, the minute you get to Eugene, what's being used now is 58% of Medicare. And that's the OMAP fee-for-service schedule. So we get into some pretty complicated numbering to try and figure out, you know, how you would tie this to Medicare or how you tie it to OMAP, you know, percentage of OMAP fee for service or whatever. And that's why I think that, you know, in terms of trying to figure out what the number is, we need a little bit more time because we're still trying to make sure that you don't tip over a plan. 80% would probably work for all of us in Portland, but it would put LIPA out of business. That's why we need more time.
That's why I don't want to
do that necessarily. I'm sorry.
All right.
Sorry, Jeff.
It is quite obvious that we have some issues with A15. It is obvious that we have.
Mr. Chair.
Can I go for
you? You haven't defined LIPA.
No, please.
Who's LIPA?
Oh, I'm sorry. That's the Lane Independent Physicians Association, the Lane County fully capitated health plan. Sorry.
Senator Domenech, please.
Well, Mr. Chair, I was just trying to figure out what we're doing as far as process is concerned and whether it's a choice between the A10s and the A15s or if it's something else. I think I'm sensing the committee agrees that it ought to be a blank with respect to the figure on line 15 and the A15 amendments. But there were some other issues here with respect to the mandate. One takes the mandate away. One keeps the mandate. Is that a choice the committee wants to decide today, or
no?
We do not.
No.
Thank you for that direction, Mr. Chair.
Thank you for allowing me to direct you.
Absolutely.
We also have some issues with the dash 17. We've already discussed this dash 17 issues. I already redlined that one. Dash 18, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the hospital, the bills that came to you had certain criteria that the Office of Health Care Policy and Research would use when determining when to contract with a physician care organization, and this would make the department's use of those discretionary, or have them only consider them as opposed to apply them directly, giving them more flexibility.
Questions, concerns, objections to the Senator Bill Fisher?
Yeah, I thought I had something down here on 18, but maybe I didn't. I'll spring it on you tomorrow.
All right. Please do. We may get hit tomorrow, but not today. Age 19, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the bill currently would allow the department, or directs the department, to contract with fully capitated health plans for certain administrative services, or for administrative services for certain services. What the A19 amendments do would is to allow or require that the department also contract with a mental health organization, which is a managed care mental health organization, to contract with those services. And so that it would allow FTIPs or MHOs to contract to administer all prescription drugs. So it also removes the limitation on prescription drugs. And finally requires that FTIPs and MHOs that contract with the department provide administrative management to develop and implement local drug management strategies for those contracts. And finally, it maintains the current administrative carve-out of antipsychotics and antidepressant drugs. The big change is that MHOs would also be able to get ASO contracts, and then in those areas, if a MHO were contracted to do prescription drugs, that an FTIP or an MHO would have to work together to jointly to manage those drugs, and it also maintains the carve-out.
Questions?
Yeah, Mr. Chair.
Senator Fisher.
I apologize. It was... section 18, I looked at it, was referring to 12. I got a question on 12 I want to bring up afterward.
Okay. We're on 19.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we did 19. We're going to 20.
That is correct. I was trying to go back and forth on 19 and reach closure. Well, let's go on to 20.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, currently the Department of Human Services has a contract and provides some of its fee-for-service prescription drugs through a mail-order pharmacy. The A20 amendments would require that if an FTIP or a PCO were to offer mail-order pharmacy services, and none of them now do, that they would be required to use the same pharmacy that the department has on contract. The amendments also clarify that this does not apply, exempts Kaiser from this provision, and finally sunsets it on January 2nd, 2008.
Senator Carter, please use questions.
Is there another company that does mail order drugs? In Oregon.
Senator Carter, in Oregon, or for clients of the health plan, or for?
For clients of the health plan.
No. Right now, the department has one contract to do this, to provide those services.
Mr. Chair.
Is it with this company that we're doing right now?
Mr. Chair, Senator Carter, yes.
So is this legal in the sense that it sounds like protectionism to me, so is that legal?
Mr. Chair, Senator Carter, that's a good question. Given that no, can that service be restricted? The answer is, I'm starting to question it, and the answer is, to be honest, I haven't done the research to answer that question really clearly.
Mr. Chairman, I just think it's incumbent upon us before we pass it, if there is any legal doubt whatsoever in terms of this particular piece. I think if they're already doing the job, it's fine, but I'm just wondering about the legality of it. Thank you.
Representative Alan Bates.
Mr. Chair, three of the FCHIPs at the present time are doing 90 days. I just found out 90-day prescriptions, and they're doing through their PBMs, not through this organization. This is aimed at Well Partners, which is a good organization. Is contract for state and fee for service, and has done a great job for us. they're in danger of losing a lot of business if we move to managed care, because those patients move out. Mm-hmm. They bid a contract based on that patient population and are in real danger from it, and so they're trying to recapture the market. And I understand what they're trying to do, and it's not unreasonable. But it does lead to the very question Senator Carter's brought up of tying the hands of the FCHIP so they have to go with one organization, breaking the contracts they already have with PBMs, and it makes it very difficult for both parties in this. I think we need to research this a lot more carefully before we have any idea of what we're voting on here. I think there's a lot of questions unanswered.
All right.
Mr. Fisher. Yeah, how long are these contracts that they have?
They have a contract with the PBM, and then through the PBM, three of them at least are doing long-term 90-day prescriptions. Most of the FCHIPs don't want to do 90-day prescriptions because eligibility is constantly changing, and if you buy a 90-day prescription for a patient who then leaves you 30 days later, you paid for drugs that you weren't capitated for. To answer your questions, I don't know for sure. Most of these contracts run for 1 to 2 years.
Mr. Chair, I'm not as concerned about the existing contracts as I am with the one with the state and how long that runs, that they would have been expecting to have a certain level of payment.
Could I ask Paul Nielsen to come up, please? This is his amendment.
Jim knows this time.
We will find out some answers here, please.
Now, perhaps, Mr. Chair, it might be that we would need to have something that would extend till all contracts had been successfully satisfied.
Please, you've heard the fray that we're involved in here on this amendment, which has got some caused some issues.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the question, Senator Carter, members of the committee. And I'm Paul Nielsen and represent WellPartner, which is an Oregon-owned and Oregon-based mail-order pharmacy, which, as Holly pointed out, won the bid for fee-for-service Medicaid mail-order delivery. We thought of the question of the existing contracts, and one of the concepts that came up was, and Holly, jump in here if you can help me on this one, but these entities are, it looks like, some of them are created in the bill, so it would be presumably then they wouldn't be able to have existing contracts with respect to mail order. That would be one thing. The reason for the Kaiser amendment was my own creative thinking. I was not asked by Kaiser to put that in. It was just that I wanted to avoid that entanglement in case it turned out to be an existing contract or situation that could be avoided. And then also in talking with WellPartner. WellPartner is apparently integrated with many, if not all, of the PBMs that are likely to be doing business. And I think it needs to be pointed out that mail order in general is a very underutilized, if utilized at all, as a tool for prescription drugs. So contracts about mail order, either they're not working or they don't, you know, I'm not saying they don't exist, but it would be unlikely, it would seem to us, that they would be an entanglement because of that. So we have thought of the problem, okay. And we'd just like to point out that this is one of the aspects of a transitional policy that we would hope the committee would think about, in that this is one policy that works, that could work a lot better than it does. It was started in the present environment under the present fee-for-service, and that's also why we put in the transition to have a sunset on 2008. And to Senator Fisher's point, that is the demise of the contract with WellPartner.
Further questions, concerns, comments?
Thanks. Paul, are there any other mail order companies in Oregon other than yours, the one you represent?
There are no other mail order companies that are free and independent in Oregon. I believe there is a mail order through one of the chain stores that's owned by a chain store, but it only serves them. Or I shouldn't say that. It doesn't only serve them, but it's run by them. And then there's also, of course, Kaiser has a fairly sophisticated mail order operation, but it's not a freestanding company.
Thank you. Senator John Menace.
Well, did we get an answer to when this contract terminates with WellPartner?
2008, and it's reviewed
I believe that for performance objectives, it's reviewed yearly.
All right, and the question that I have for counsel is whether or not there's any exposure in terms of breach of contract on behalf of the state. If we change, well, what I'm saying is Wellpartner entered into a contract with the state of Oregon with certain assumptions about what income and revenue and commitment they would make, and if we, by legislation, in essence, de facto destroy that set of assumptions, is there a contract issue here? In other words, can they sue us?
Mr. Chair, Senator Menas, based on your those conditions, no, I can't. I mean, they can always sue us.
Well, tell me why it's not a breach of contract if we extinguish, in essence, the very customers that they wrote the contract, assuming.
Mr. Chair, Senator Menas, if the contract is worth the attorney time that went into writing it, I'm sure there's language on both sides that should conditions change, there's the ability to change the contract. And so, despite the anticipation of some individuals moving out of fee-for-service and into managed care, all contracts have escape clauses on both sides.
With the exception of PERS.
Except for PERS. And so I'm sure that there's language that would allow Wellpartner to escape as well as the state escaping.
Yes, yeah, right.
A few other certain things that we're
on the state.
Well, Mr. Chairman.
There's no guarantee of business, I don't think. That you can.
Well, okay. And I just want to say for the committee, because I have no clue and no association or familiarization with this particular company, but I do think that if the issue is brought before the committee and we're making a major policy change in terms of healthcare delivery systems and we're, in essence, significantly adversely affecting a company that does have a contract with the state, that's very different than trying to privilege a company that comes to us and asks for a book of business or privilege that they didn't previously have. So I think the committee ought to take into consideration the fact that there is a business that does have a contract, that does have an expectation that the business would continue. And however we resolve that issue, I do think it's an important one that we honor that to the extent it's practicable to do so.
Thank you.
May I make one more comment, Mr. Chair? Thank you for that comment, Senator Menas. And I also wanted to go back to Senator Carter's original question here. This is not just an issue about the volume of business for Wellpartner. If it were just that, then they would just go out and market, you know, their product more. The problem is that because of the exemptions in the bill for the psychotropic drugs, it dramatically changes the mix that they bid on in the first place. So they cannot get, there are calculated losses within this contract on drugs that they can't get the discounts on. And if the bill should pass and if the psychotropics are exempted, then that flaws the contract in terms of the way they can get the discounts. And so it's not just simply a matter of the volume, is what I'm trying to say.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, just for me, that was not an issue. I think that we should support Oregon companies, but I just wanted to know, were we getting into a possible conflict if there's another Oregon company out there? I think that we should support Oregon companies and support your company, but I wouldn't want to do that had there been another Oregon company in the same business. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All right. There's some issues, obviously, with the A-20 amendments. A-21.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the A-21 amendments contain a number of what I will call patient protection language in them, though the language in the bill comes primarily from two places. One, a lot of what's being asked to be codified in Oregon law is what's required under the federal Medicaid Advanced Care Organization rules and regulations. So some of this would be required by the managed care organizations at the federal level. And then there's also a provision that takes a requirement that currently commercial insurers have, which would require enrollees have an opportunity to participate in the development and implementation of policies, which now applies to commercial insurers, and apply it to managed care organizations under the health plan. And finally, it limits or prohibits a health plan from limiting enrollment based on zip code within their designated areas.
Thank you. Concerns, questions, objections? So, John Menas.
I just want to ask a question. I'm looking at the notes here. It says it requires DHS to ensure that organization provides certain services to enrollees. Those services are?
These are considered access standards, basically, Mr. Chair, Senator Menas. And if you look at them, I mean, these are would be contract requirements. They're also required by federal, under the Federal Medicaid Act,
right.
And they would be services like.
It's basically required under federal law, is what you're saying. That's good.
Maintaining and monitoring a network of providers, ensuring female enrollees with direct access. That's nice.
Okay, good. Others? Okay. How about A22, please?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the A22 amendments, first of all, they start out by removing Section 12, I believe, the ASO section of the bill currently, and then in its place would exempt the purchase of medical supplies from public contracting laws by the department so that they could sole source for medical supplies, and second would require the department to provide local department offices and area agencies with standardized forms and training on requirements for prior authorization.
Say section 12 or 10.
Did I misspeak? It's section
10.
I want to know why. I misspoke. Section 10.
Senator Kate Brown wishes to ask a question.
And Ali, I think actually this is the proponent of the amendment. Why would we exempt DHS while they purchase medical supplies from the public contracting law?
Mr. Chair, Senator Brown, as I understand it, they wanted to sole source for, when we wanted to be able to sole source bids for certain supplies. I think their belief was it would be cheaper.
I'm sorry, say that again.
They wanted to sole source certain medical supplies, believing it would be cheaper for the department. But you can ask them with the information.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Bill Morissette.
I'd like to hear from the proponent of 22 on why we should.
Please come forward. Proponents are coming forward. Senator Kate Brown also wishes that information.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I am not here as the proponent of this amendment, but I think that I was maybe the source of some of the confusion around the contracting rules. I'm sorry, I'm Tina Kitchen.
Thank you.
The medical director for the Department of Human Services, Seniors and People with Disabilities. One, when we were contemplating how to save money around this, the question came up, were there other things that we could do to save OHP funds? And one of the things that I talked about was the ability to bid for a sole source, not sole source bidding. In other words, to talk about doing a bid for a sole source of supplier for, say, incontinent supplies or something else would actually possibly save money. And I apologize for the confusion.
Do you have any there?
Not on this particular one, the second piece to this idea.
I have a question.
Sure.
Do you have the ability to do that without this being in the statute?
I do believe so. I was not recommending that this was included in amendment. It was a confusion.
We need more? Do we have any? I think we're okay. Representative Alan Bates, then we go to Senator Bill Fisher.
Very quickly, sir. Section 10 was designed to deal with the cost of durable medical goods, which we found on investigation in our committee work that much of what was being purchased was being purchased at extremely high prices compared to what the commercial market bought. And this designed to take care of that. There's also language in here to exempt certain individuals from that under department rules. So we have people who have very fragile health or have special medical needs that they are exempted from this section. We found that people getting oxygen and certain other durable medical goods were in the department had not been able to manage those in a way that was cost effective. And these things were being purchased at extremely high prices. An example of that would be in my area that the best payer for oxygen therapy and some durable medical goods is not the commercial market, it's not the Medicare market, it's OHP. And that's primarily on the fee-for-service basis. This was a way of helping contain those costs. We know that the F-chips did a good job of managing this. We also put language in here, though, that would exempt certain individuals in the department to decide who those medically fragile people were so they would not come under this restriction. Okay.
Thank you. Further?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, we had a real knockdown and drag out a couple years ago concerning the
sole sourcing of these durable medical goods and the problems involved with everything from weather and distance and holidays and weekends and all of this, distributing these supplies out around the state so that these people had them in a proper time. And there are many manifold problems with sole sourcing when it comes to especially rural areas. It's one thing maybe to be able to bring a big warehouse into Portland or Eugene or something like that and have pretty good access around there, but we have situations where we've had roads tied up for 3 or 4 or 5 days with snowstorms and all this kind of thing, and to mess up the service system for not only the people that are on the Oregon Health Plan, but to jeopardize perhaps a business in an area that was servicing a whole bunch of other people that were not on the Oregon Health Plan because of the loss of business, that was very, very, very difficult to put a price on and put an easy solution to how we would control and how we would get things out and guarantee that somebody had the exact things that they needed in a timely basis. And there was no satisfactory answer basically from OMAP at that point in time, and we vigorously opposed what they were trying to do. And I would probably still be of that nature to oppose that if unless they could show me a whole lot of different things than they were able to show me a couple of years ago.
Okay. Yarker, do you wish to speak?
I do, Mr. Chair. Thank you. For the record, Jacqueline Zimmer, the Area Agencies on Aging and Disabilities. First of all, just to clarify something that Senator Brown asked the other day, and Representative Bates, again, I'm going to let you, you're going to have to take me out and hit me over the head with this bill until it sinks in. But for our people with disabilities, they are not all on Medicare. They are only on Medicare if they have a work history, if they've established a pattern of practice where they worked and paid into the system. So a number of them are not. And so they don't fall underneath that category of exemptions for this bill, as it says that people with Medicare are exempted. So there is that piece to keep in mind, I think, when you're talking about how people with disabilities are already sort of covered in here. And I think the other day the committee, there was some thinking that if you were disabled, you were automatically on Medicare, and therefore you were covered under exemptions here. One of the reasons, and I'm sorry, I don't know where the first part of this amendment came in either, but the second part is ours. And the reason that we're asking to maintain the existing system of exemptions for things like durable medical equipment is because familiarity, I think, breeds good service, and fragmenting the system, I think, does not. And what we're trying to state is not sure that there's any guarantee that an ASO will do a better job of serving the actual client than our system already does. I think, quite honestly, that's a fairly new system, having an ASO. I'm not sure that I personally just don't know if they have a proven track record in other states where it shows that they're doing a good job by the client. So since we're a provider of services to people and not business kind of thing, we would argue that it's better to have our clients connect with our case managers to connect with the services that they need when they need them and the quantities that they need when they need them. We have an awful lot of people with disabilities who rely heavily on incontinent products, and those are the kind of things that get capped by managed care organizations, and I think it's just one of those dignity issues for us. And then our suggestion is that you ought to strengthen the system you already have in place. If what you have found is that there's not a standard form for these prior authorizations, then we should create one. If there's not enough training, then we should do that and just strengthen our own Oregon system rather than outsourcing this to some ASO that could be from anywhere that may not be familiar with our model of long-term care, may not be, you know, just may not know our system well enough to see what we believe works in order to keep our own citizens sort of healthy and in the prevention rather than damage control mode. So that's what we were looking for when we put this in there. Just that darn dignity thing again. So, and then just not fragmenting the system. So just parceling this out, I think, is nerve-wracking for our clients.
Senator Marsette.
Now, is this going to conflict with Amendment 10? And if so, how?
I think it conflicts with A19, to be honest with you. The first line in A19.
Okay.
But 10.
Well, what does it conflict with, is my question.
Well, I think it does the same thing with A19 when you're talking about requiring the inclusion of MHOs and providing administrative services for eligible persons. I mean, I think that's the opposite of what we're looking for here.
So we're down to 22. But, well, it appears as though we've got some problems with this particular one, Holly, and I think you probably have noted that.
And Madam Chair, for the record, this sure isn't Holly's fault.
There's a lot that isn't Holly's fault, just for the record. Okay. A23.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, what this amendment does is just clarify when a person is enrolled in a fee-for-service payment system, and it's not only when a managed care entity is not able to serve additional clients, it's also when there is not in a designated area the type of managed care organization that provides the services that the person is seeking. So, for example, this happens to come from the dentist. So if there's not a DCO in a particular area, in a designated area, then it would the person would be enrolled in fee-for-service.
We're just getting up and
down.
Mr. Chairman, a question.
Sure.
Holly, what if 23 kids were accepted, why would not the 15-mile rule was used? Wouldn't that be an appropriate place for the 15-mile rule?
I can't hear you.
Would that be an appropriate place for the 15-mile rule to apply? Mr. Chair, Senator Carter, the definition of reasonable access in a rural health context, 15, and in certain circumstances, 15 miles probably makes some sense from a policy directive. Whether or not you want to apply it across the board to every situation, I think probably would give you unintended consequences that at this point we don't have the time to think through.
Okay.
Further questions, comments, concerns? A23.
We just finished that one.
You did.
Yeah. You're on 25.
Just go to number 25, Mr. Dramaticus.
Anything else on this 25?
We're just starting.
Are we through 23?
Mm-hmm.
Can we go to 25?
Mm-hmm.
We're on A25.
There, members of the committee. A25 do a number of things. First of all, another category, another descriptor of individuals who would be exempt from the mandatory enrollment requirements, and that would be individuals who are living in long-term care facilities, residential facilities, or licensed adult foster care homes. Second, it would incorporate an anyone provider provision and make it applicable to fully captive health plans, prohibiting them from discriminating against providers who are willing to meet the terms and conditions for participation in the plan.
Can I ask what that means?
Senator Carter wants to know what you just said.
Well, thank you.
Mr. Chair, Senator Carter, an any willing provider provision is a provision basically in statute, because that's how the Supreme Court is looking at them, that has said historically in a commercial insurance market, if there is a provider out there, and sometimes but not always it's a allied health type of provider that wants to participate in your plan, that and if that provider is willing to meet the terms and conditions of your plan, that you have to let them in. That issue has been heavily litigated and was resolved by the United States Supreme Court in April of this year, where the U.S. Supreme Court upheld an any willing provider statute that was written in Kentucky that said to commercial insurers, if there's a provider out there, if this is a covered service and there's a provider out there that wants to provide that service, then that you have to let that provider in so long as they accept your terms and conditions.
Okay.
And the U.S. Supreme Court looked at that issue from a enrollee rights client protection kind of position and said, if I have this health plan and I'm entitled to X service and this provider can provide X service, that the health insurance company has to provide it to me. What this provision does is basically apply that same principle or concept to fully capitated health plans and says if there are types of providers, if what the fully capitated health plan is contracted to provide can be provided by a provider other than who's on the panel, and that provider can legally provide that service, then a fully capitated health plan cannot discriminate against a provider, and if that provider is willing to accept their terms and conditions, has to let them in.
Gotcha.
Senator Bill Fisher, please.
Yes, Mr. Chair. On section 3, page 1.
Of the amendment?
The A25 amendment in of section 3. The one that exempts people residing in long-term care facilities.
Oh, yeah.
And then it says residential facilities.
Mm-hmm.
What is, or is there a statutory definition of residential facilities?
Mr. Chair,
this is a different term than we normally use. We generally say residential care facilities or community-based care, that kind of thing. What is this?
Mr. Chair, Senator Fisher, there is, in fact, a definition of residential facility that encompasses residential care facilities, assisted living facilities, residential training facilities, registered residential care facilities, basically all of the...
mental health group homes.
Correct. Any group home, any congregate living situation, either more than five or less than five. And this is the definition that's basically used in the licensing statute, so I didn't specifically tie it, and it's probably as broad as it can be in terms of what is licensed as a residential facility.
Okay, well, I just wanted to make sure, Mr. Chair, that you did cover that, because this is a little different terminology than we normally refer to those groups, and I wanted to make sure that we hadn't left anyone out.
Mr. Chair, Senator Fisher, that's exactly why I picked it.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Questions, concerns, objections? Senator Kate Brown.
Thanks. Holly, is there any reason anything in the dash A25 amendments couldn't be done by rule, or do we need to, are there certain provisions that need to be done by statute?
Mr. Chair, Senator Brown, let me just finish a few other things that are in here, and then
okay.
I'll put and then answer your question. And there are a couple of other provisions in the A25s. One, it addresses, as the committee is aware, there's a provision in here that directs the department to contract with basically Kaiser Permanente to provide certain health services under the health plan. And there's a provision in here that says that contract can't be the only contract in that area and that there must be other contracts. It requires that all of these contracts be cost neutral. It replaces the terminology and has the department contracting with the pharmacy benefit administrator rather than a manager for the drug services, and has a reporting requirement and then modifies that. Mr. Chair, Senator Brown, in answer to your question about what can be done by rule, certainly the additional exemptions for people from mandatory enrollment can be... I suspect that the any willing provider provision would have to be by statute. The third one, because in this case the department would not be writing these rules to direct themselves to do this. They would either do it or not do it, whether or not. I mean, in this case, legislative directive. This is not something they couldn't do by rule because they're not directing themselves to do something. Should the department decide to do something different with the BPA, their BPA than they have been, arguably that could be done by rule. And the reporting requirements, I mean, certainly the department could request the same information whether or not there's legislative directives.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Fisher.
I thought that I wouldn't hesitate to malign any particular person that was available at the state level at this point in time. There's a certain level of distrust with the operation of OMAP in the past that I think is carrying over, and we'd like to see as many things outlined in here as we can get without actually getting into the micromanagement process. So I would say that that's a good reason why I would support dash 25 amendments.
Thank you. Representative Alan Bates, please.
Thank you. Holly, does any willing provider apply to Medicaid and Medicare plans? Do you think that the Supreme Court will apply that to all plans or just commercial plans?
What?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bates, I asked myself that same question this afternoon and haven't had time to reread the opinion to decide what I think the answer is. So the answer is I don't know yet, but as soon as I reread the opinion, I'll formulate an opinion.
Mr. Chair, I'd like, if I could just take a moment, I'd like to hear from the plans what this might do to them having any willing provider as far as cost of the plan is concerned. I don't know if anyone here from the plan would step up and answer that question or feels comfortable doing it. I just don't know the result of an any willing provider being inserted into the Medicaid program. I think it might be very costly, or maybe not. I just don't know.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jeff Hetherington, representing the fully capitated health plans. we're not. I think the concern we would have, and not having seen this until today, is this gives us no control in terms of administrating our panel. And I'm not talking about whether we let in certain groups or not certain groups. This would seem to take away our ability to supervise the providers that are on our panel, because you have to take them no matter what, if that's what the intent is. We think that... just in first reading of this is an odd combination of provisions. And if there are certain things in here that some of you may like, I would probably suggest that we take a good hard look at it and split certain things out and put them into the -26s, if I could be so bold without Marjorie looking at me shooting spitballs. But, you know, in looking at this in balance, it's sort of a goulash we haven't been able to make sense out of, but it doesn't seem to sit right. That's about all I can. And the thing that concerns me is being able to manage our providers.
Sir John Menace, please.
Just on the kind of following up Dr. Bates' question here, the willing provider issue that applies. The court case applies to commercial. Sure. As far as you know, is that
Mr. Chair, Senator Minister, that's absolutely correct.
Right. So if there's a subsequent case and there was an application to Medicaid programs, the department would have to honor that.
Right. If that issue were litigated and went up to the Supreme Court, yes.
So would it be fair to say it's sufficiently unclear at this time?
Oh, absolutely, Mr. Chair, Senator Minister. I don't know whether or not that it is applicable by just as a result of that case or not. But I do want to clarify something that Mr. Hetherington said. Any willing provider language allows you to supervise any. You have to expand your panel of providers, but you supervise them in the same way that you supervise your current panel. So that piece, that would not change.
Thank you. Other questions?
Yes.
Bill Morissette, please.
I'd like to know what the last bullet means. I don't understand the last bullet on this. Under 25-25 requires annual reporting of an aggregate amount of pharmaceutical rebates. Can you explain that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Morissette, I can explain it, or would you like the proponents to explain it?
Well, I like the proponents.
Thank you.
I'm happy to, but I've talked enough. I get boring.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Tom Holt with the Oregon State Pharmacists Association. The A25s are our amendments. In answer to the question regarding the rebate language, what this language will do is require the plans on an annual basis to report to the state how much in rebates in total that they are expecting to receive or have received for that year's business. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, it specifically says that the plans would not have to report, for instance, the particular rebate agreement that they have with a certain manufacturer for a certain product, because those individual agreements are contractual matters that are for many reasons worked out in great with a great deal of confidentiality. However, we think it is important for the state to be able to evaluate in looking at the question of rebates in what rebates the plans are getting under their contracts, and look at how that plays into the capitation rate, and also how it compares then to fee-for-service costs. In the fee-for-service Medicaid arena, generally there are the highest rebates possible available, a minimum of 15.1%, so by federal law. So that's the reason for that. If I may, Mr. Chair, I'd also like to address two of the earlier questions.
Sure.
Senator Brown asked if these items in these amendments could be done by rule. I suppose technically a number of them could be. However, as Senator Fisher noted, there's a little bit of lack of confidence that these things would be carried out by rule. Just for example, we have had chronic problems with reasonably prompt payment by certain payers who are subcontractors to the Medicaid contractors. And the department has not been able to really bring leverage to bear on that, and neither have the plans in their defense in some cases. And so this is, you know, just would put hard and fast in statute some of those things that we need in the delivery system from our standpoint. In regard to the any willing provider language, the contentious issue in any willing provider for a number of years has been mainly dealing with the question of ERISA and federal, where the federal government's regulation of insurance takes place versus state level of insurance, and what the Supreme Court, as I understand it, recently decided is that states can have local any willing provider laws. The question of whether that applies to Medicaid specifically, I'm not sure either. However, I would suggest that it's a little bit different issue, and that the if the state has a Medicaid plan, the state has a great deal. ERISA doesn't come into play here. You're not talking about interstate commerce. From our perspective, the any willing provider is important for a couple of reasons. Mainly, however, to ensure that we maintain community access to services. Right? For example, in some areas of this state, it is not unusual to have 40% or 50% of a pharmacy's book of business be Oregon Health Plan. And under this bill, that's all going to go to managed care. And if we have a managed care plan decide that they're going to exclude a pharmacy, in effect, that's a death sentence for that pharmacy because they would lose so much business. And we just want to protect against that downside risk in the health plan.
Thank you, Mr. Holt. All right.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Bill Fisher.
Yeah, I'd like to go back and one
thing that
we haven't covered.
That's correct. I'm sorry.
Section 18, the -12 amendment, which speaks to the time that the waiver would go into effect. We have a date that I understand that we have to have a plan in vogue, which is September 1, in order to get the maximum amount of return from the new program as a continuation of what we've been doing. Does that need to be in this bill? Does it need to be in, for instance, Section 18 or in the A-12 amendment or in some other amendment?
Learned High Council, can you answer that question?
Mr. Chair, Senator Fisher, as I understand your question is, do we have to tie together what the state's going to be doing in order to be eligible for FMAP money, for the new federal money, and the provisions of this bill? And I believe that you'll get nods or head shakes behind me. I believe the answer is no, that the department will do certain things in going forward in anticipation of that money, but this bill is not directly tied to it. I think we plan on spending it, but I don't think the provisions of this bill are contingent on it.
Mr. Chair, one follow-up. So in other words, we won't find ourselves out on a limb having to maybe get only a portion of what we would have coming from the federal dollars because somebody didn't have everything done by September 1 or what it should be done by September 1, or should this be in another bill?
Mr. Chair, Senator Fisher, again, as I understand it, I don't think that the state has to do anything per se in order to be eligible for that money, for the new money. And so I don't think we have to do anything in this bill to address those issues. Either.
Or any other bill?
Correct. I have not heard yet. It's not been brought to my attention that we need to do something specific in order to maintain the state's eligibility for the new money.
In other words, I have not seen and ear hath not heard nor has entered into the mind of man.
Well, I'm with the chair, Senator Fisher. I won't go that far.
All right, thank you. Thank you very much, Holly, for your...
That's coming to you. Now, we spent 2 hours and 10 minutes on these amendments. Are these the end of amendments?
You never know when amendments are going to end. So these are these amendments. Are the other concerns we brought before the committee tomorrow or today?
Yeah.
Okay, tomorrow we'll come back.
Just a quick question.
Yes, you know, how do you know there's no questions that I never do? They don't raise their hands. Senator John Menace, please.
I've been raising my hand a lot, but you're ignoring me.
It's not true.
I feel slighted.
Did you write me, oh, my God?
Who did?
Okay. Mr. John Menace, please.
With respect to the discussion on 25.
25.
The only part of that that appears rational to me is the reporting requirement issue. I just want to kind of lay that out, because when we get to discussing, I'm not going to support anything other than the reporting requirement stuff makes sense, so you kind of have a sense for what the rebates are. The rest of it, as far as I'm concerned, is not Christmas. And, kind of
okay. Holly, I realize your life is not good now in terms of the hours you're putting in. Could you develop an amendment on just the last bullet on dash 25 for John Menace, please? Call it the dash whatever you want amendment. And that, there is an amendment that's going to be drafted. Anybody else wants to talk about amendments they want Holly to kill herself developing, please?
Oh, Mr. Chair.
Yes?
I do believe we need to fix the dash, the Jacqueline Zimmer problem.
Oh.
Sorry, for lack of better word.
Well, I don't know if we can fix it tonight.
Well, so. No, but I understand that. I just think that amendment needs to be addressed.
I think we highlighted those with
okay.
question marks.
Yeah, we've gone through every one of them, none of these things. There's some hot. We're going to come back tomorrow and start to move some of these amendments, hopefully, some of them, because I realize that's what we hope to do, to keep after we get it done.
I thought you said you were going to unqualify my life on this and get through with this.
Well, I didn't get through with it, so you're coming back. When do we come back tomorrow?
3
p.m. tomorrow. We're going to try it again to
that's
keep...
That's what I mean. Tomorrow we're getting through with
that's
it.
What, well, I don't know if we're going to get through. We'll see what we get done. The intention is we're going to keep... We're going to start working amendments into the bill. We adjourn. Thanks, everybody, for coming here and staying till 6 o'clock. Not that anybody heard what I just said, because you're all walking out, not listening to anything I say. And I'm still on the record, and I haven't adjourned. I just wish somebody in the audience would say, I'm here, you for God's sakes.